I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the Ruler Podcast. I'm Jack Thurston, and I've been presenting the podcast since way back in the mists of time. Well, issue 24 of the magazine. It's now issue 57, and as a wise man by the name of George Harrison once sang, all things must pass. The fact is, it's become increasingly difficult for me to present the podcast in person, which is the way it should be done. And so I'm delighted that Ian Parkinson has stepped up to the mic. And he'll be taking the podcast into a brave new future. Meatier, beatier, bigger, and more bouncy. At least that's what he's told me. Ian is a vastly experienced radio reporter and producer, and no mean bike racer either, so you're in very good hands. You can still catch me on the Bike Show podcast, find it on iTunes. But for now, from me on the Ruler podcast, it's happy trails, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Hello and welcome to the Ruler podcast for issue 57. I'm Ian Parkinson and we're back once again in the historic and slightly windy again surroundings of Herne Hill Velodrome in South London, where you may be able to hear a new generation of young people being introduced to the delights of track racing in the background. I'm joined once again by the Ruler editor, Ian Cleverley, and, I'm delighted to say, by Ned Bolting. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you very much. Again.
Quite a bit to talk about in issue 57. Hopefully we'll be talking about Sean Kelly. We'll be taking a look at a, frankly, rather eccentric attempt to redesign the Musette. We've got an example of one redesign with us, and we may even try it out later on, so Oof. Do stay listening for that. And we'll be talking about our favourite photos from issue 57, and then, of course, there's the Ruler competition. First of all, though, Ned, did you have a good Tour de France?
I did, yeah. It's the dust has settled. It always takes me a while when I get back from the race just to sift it through and try and figure out what kind of a race it was. And on balance... And in opposition to, or as a point of difference to last year's race, I thought this was a cracker.
Because there was a point, wasn't there? Yeah. So I think it was it stage 10 where everyone thought, oh, that's it then, Chris Froome's won.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going to be much more of a race. But actually, it turned into quite a reasonable race in the end.
Yeah, really. He only took time out of his rivals on that one. It happened to be the first mountain stage in the Pyrenees. And after that, it was a question of, you know, keeping everyone in checkmate and then slowly weakening his grip. So it had all that kind of upward trajectory from his arrivals, or at least from Quintana, towards the end. So it held its drama right to the last. And actually, in the 13 tours I've done, I don't recall seeing a penultimate stage, so the, you know, stage 20, if you like, whether that's a mountaintop finish or a time trial, that held the race so much in the balance. I mean, we've had, I think when Cadel Evans won, he had to overcome Andy Schleck in the final time trial, but everyone knew that was going to happen. Whereas there was genuinely kind of 20 minutes or half an hour of racing on Alpe d'Huez between Quintana and Froome, during which you did not know. You really didn't know whether the Tour de France was going to be thrown away at the last.
And they brought time bonuses back, didn't they? Did that seemed to make a bit of a difference to the race.
Yeah, I mean, whether they'll hang around, I don't know. I mean, I was delighted to see the back of them when they were first abolished. But actually, you know, it's just freshened things up again and it produced a slightly different race. I suspect you might lose them again next year because it's the Proudhon way, isn't it? Just to keep everything kind of, you know, the deck being shuffled all the time. But I think it worked on this edition, yeah, for sure.
Ian, did you manage to get out and see any of the stages?
No. Frankly.
Did you enjoy it watching at home, though?
I was office bound. I did enjoy watching it at home. I thought it was a great race. And it's interesting that, was it after stage 10 where everybody went, oh, the race is over? And it's, people have this kind of, these rose-tinted spectacles, like, it was so fantastic back in the day, it was always clear. No, it wasn't. Mm. It was ever thus. Mm, mm. And you get out of the race, you just have to sort of look at other aspects of it. You know, look at some of the fantastic stage wins. And it was interesting talking to one of the riders last week, interviewing one of the riders last week, and him saying how on the tour there's no such thing as an easy day anymore. Whereas back in when he started, you could guarantee there'd be seven stages where you could just sit in all day and then sprint at the end and recover. And that doesn't happen anymore. And that is happening in all three Grand Tours. They're all ramping up the pressure, aren't they? And making turn them into a different sort of animal. And it's great for us TV spectators because there is never a dull day, is there? But
no, I mean, you're absolutely right about Twas Ever Thus. I mean, it certainly seems to have been the way ever since I've been following Grand Tours. You yearn for, in the first week before you get to those mountain stages, you yearn for the decisiveness of the mountain stage and what that's going to deliver to the race. And then as soon as it's happened and someone's won, you kind of go,
start moaning about it.
What was that all about? Now the race is over. But actually, so it's always been that dichotomy, hasn't it, between... Yeah. You know, forcing a decisive moment and then the aftermath of a decisive moment is a kind of I thought he balanced that. Prudhomme has a knack, and it's partly luck as well. Quintana was on the top of Alpe d'Huez, and you do, you know, day after day after day watching these guys and their body language behind the podium, because both Froome and Quintana were on the podium every day, because Quintana was in the white jersey, of course. But he was genuinely distraught before he pulled himself together and started to do his interviews, because you could read his mind. He knew that Prudhomme had designed a Tour de France with him in mind, with no long individual time trial. That was his tour. I mean, he may well come back and win next year's and the year after that, who knows? But that was the first golden opportunity for Quintana, and he should have attacked Froome earlier with more vigour, and he should have won that tour.
Well, I was going to ask if, you know, Froome is, lots of things can happen, but if Froome is back next year and fit and, you know, not injured, can anyone beat him? Can you see anyone beating him?
Yeah, Nairo Quintana can beat him.
But he didn't do it this year.
No, he didn't. But, you know, I'm sitting down and doing the maths because I'm about to commentate on the Vuelta, when it's kind of a rematch between all the top four in the Tour de France, minus Contador, but plus Fabio Aru and Mikel Landa as well, which adds to the intrigue. But anyway, I was looking at the direct comparison between Quintana and Froome, and if you take out the 1:20 that Quintana lost when he was held up on stage two, and then the, 4 seconds he lost to Froome on the time trial and little bits and pieces here and there, basically that was, you know, Quintana did him in the mountains, did him. So I think Quintana can win the tour, especially if the next time an individual time trial comes around, it's a mountain time trial as there was in 2013. You know, there's every chance that can happen.
One of the things we were talking about on the podcast last time was the new generation of French riders, and actually when we were talking last time, they weren't doing particularly well at that stage of the tour. Towards the end, there were sort of signs that they were going to do all right, and then they weren't. It was a bit of a unconvincing display, really, this year, wasn't it, from the young French?
It's probably where they're at the moment. They are young, emphasis on young. And Pinot and Bardet did all that they could. I think Pinot is probably, of the two, the more disappointing. But the one that I think emerged with, you know, the greatest credit out of the young French GC hopefuls was actually Warren Barguil. And the longer the race went on, the more you thought, actually, possibly of the three, he's the one. But let's judge them all in 2 or 3 years' time and not read too much into their exceptional performances of 2014, because you have to relativise that GC field. I mean, with respect to Nibali and everyone else in that race, if Jean-Christophe Perrault, at the age of 37, finishes in second place on the Tour, that's not a vintage Tour de France.
Ian, the favourite moment for you from the tour, from the armchair?
Bardet's stage win. Mm. It's Bardet's descent and stage win. Mm. So I was saying to the guys in the office that it wasn't that many years ago that I only ever was able to watch the highlights of a stage in the evening, and I'd never get to see any descending.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It was, and now it's like, yeah, I can sit and watch this whole thing. I just love it. Absolutely love it. He was absolutely storming, and just a carbon copy of his Dauphiné, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, I'm going to do it again.
Yeah,
nobody can stop him.
I thought Martin's, you know, in the first week, Tony Martin's misfortune in losing out when Cavendish allowed himself to be beaten by Fabian Cancellara in that sprint, thereby denying Tony Martin his yellow jersey, and then finally Martin getting the yellow jersey and then crashing out and breaking his bones and, you know, all that
classic Tour de France
also,
drama and
also,
theatre.
As I am so incapable of proving on this very, very velodrome where we all ride every Wednesday morning. Martin is able to win a bike race by simply riding his bicycle faster from A to B than anyone else. He just strips it down to its barest simplicity, doesn't he? And
that's what cycle sport should be, I suppose.
Right? Yes, in a way.
One question I've got to ask you, and I'm sure you've been asked it loads of times, and you're probably fed up with answering it, but watching at home, Matt Rendell,
yeah,
legend or what?
Well, that's not, you know, yeah, he is.
For me, one of the highlights was his interview, his sort of doorstep interview, although it was much too suave to be a doorstep on Laurent Jalabert. Yeah. How did he manage to pull that off?
Well, I mean, a combination of balls, really, and some pretty damn good French. And sometimes his French lets him down, but he absolutely nailed it this time. And also a good bit of preparation, because it was obvious that Jalabert was going to blank him and come back with the, "Oh, I didn't say that" line. And if he hadn't been prepared, a lesser man than Matt would have gone, okay, well, I thought you had. But actually Matt said, "Well, no, you said this, and then you said this and this" at him, to which, you know, which point Jalabert was pretty much cornered. And, you know, Matt's done this from time to time. He's a good journalist, and it was an interesting moment, wasn't it?
And you don't see it that often now, do you, on the tour? You've never seen it that much, that sort of journalism.
That kind of confrontational style. Yeah, and what was very interesting about that was, two things. It put us, I think, for a day or two, as, if you like, the ITV show, in a slightly uncomfortable position, because, he's perfectly entitled to do this, but Chris Froome, stroke Michelle Froome, who does his tweeting for him, I suspect, tweeted this and kind of thanked ITV for our contribution to the Froome defence, if you like. Now, that really wasn't what it was all about, actually. Mm. We were trying to present a balanced picture of the debate. And that interview with Jalabert was part of a balanced analysis of what we thought the Froome situation was about. So we weren't defending Chris Froome.
Did it cause any frostiness at the Village de Départ? Was Laurent Jalabert, you know,
oh, frosty! It was off the scale.
Spitting in your filthy coffee.
It was off the scale. You know, I mean, he had the look of a hunted man, actually, which made me slightly uncomfortable, because, you know, that wasn't the idea either. The idea actually was to say, come on, if you want to engage in this debate about Sky and you've got legitimate suspicions, let's hear them.
Yeah.
Let's hear them, and that was the opportunity that was genuinely presented to him on a plate, and he completely shunned that opportunity. And then you have to draw your own conclusions about his veracity, don't you?
I must confess, I haven't seen the interview, but from the gist of what I saw from Matt was basically he just put it out there and said, "Well, there you go." And then Jalabert managed to sort of hang himself, basically.
That's exactly what happened. What was interesting on the after Chris Froome kind of retweeted it and the whole thing gained a bit of traction. Then, obviously, most of the peloton on the Tour de France, because we're in France, never watch ITV's output, but all of a sudden they were watching ITV's output. They were all on Twitter, they all sit in their hotel rooms and look at this thing. What was very interesting was a couple of days later, John Degenkolb came through the finishing line, nothing to do with any of this, obviously, spotted Matt, a man he doesn't know particularly, spun round through 180 degrees, rode back to Matt, tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Are you Matt Rendell?" And Matt went, "Yes." And he said, "I just want to say, on behalf of a whole bunch of us in the peloton, thank you. And there should be more of that, tackling the old guard." Now, that doesn't say, Matt was obviously delighted and grinning from ear to ear. But actually, I think that says a lot about John Degenkolb. And it does say a lot about where we think we're at in terms of the prevailing
with
culture.
The modern peloton.
I don't want to be naive or gloss over anything, but I think there is a core, that's moving in the right direction amongst the younger riders.
Okay, we'll leave the Tour de France there. We'll talk about the Vuelta in a bit. One rider who never won the Tour de France, of course, he won a few stages of it, and he won pretty much everything else, was Sean Kelly. I've got a real fondness for Kelly, because actually he was in his prime when I first started really getting into bike racing. And he's always had a reputation of being quiet, reserved, hard man of cycling, but he seems to have transformed himself into quite an accessible character these days. And he's the subject of a fairly big article in issue 57 here. And what made you commission the piece about Sean Kelly?
I'm so sure we had Kelly back in one of the really, really early issues years ago, but he's always an intriguing man. And it is funny, that idea you get of him of being this taciturn man from Tipperary, hasn't got much to say on anything, but
He used to nod in radio interviews, didn't he?
My very favourite Eurosport David Duffield moment was when on a mountain climb, there was a rider from one team up the road, and their teammate launches off the front of the bunch and starts chasing him down. Duffield goes apoplectic, goes into this really long lead-in. He must have teed him up for 2 minutes. And he goes, Sean, I've never seen anything like this. What could it possibly be? And he was going on and on and on. And he goes, Sean. Sean goes, well, I don't know. You know, to me, that was Sean Kelly in his early days of Eurosport. You know, that would never happen now.
Although he does still have that fantastic endearing habit of adding an extra T in the word certainly so that it comes out certainly, which I think is absolutely splendid. I'm going to introduce that into all my broadcasts.
But he is a much more accessible character now, isn't he? Or he seems to be.
Yeah. I think to anybody of a certain age, he's just a legend. And yeah. And it's frightening when you start looking down at his Palmares. He won everything, man. He won anything going. You know, Colin asked him during the interview, do you think you could have won the Tour? And he says, well, yeah, in hindsight, yeah, probably. But every year, it was always the Vuelta, because his sponsor wanted him to ride the Vuelta. It was always the Classics. If he'd gone easier on one of them, you know. But he said, but every time I got to the... And then, not to mention the post-tour crits. I mean, he rode everything, you know. He just never stopped.
And that's one of the other big changes, isn't it? The idea that someone could win all the Classics and then win the Grand Tours. It's kind of unthinkable now.
Well, I mean, what this whole conversation puts me in mind of instantly is the last couple of years of being Peter Sagan, right? Mm. So Sagan is the new... Well, he's the inheritor of the Kelly mantle, isn't he? And they've called him the new Merckx, but I'd say he's much more Kelly-esque. But there's no place for Peter Sagan. As he repeatedly tells me every time he finishes second.
Peter Sagan.
Yeah. I mean, where do you go if you're Peter Sagan, if you're capable of so much? And back in Sean Kelly's era, you could win stuff and you could go on. You could win. He won the Vuelta, for heaven's sake. How can you do that as well as everything else?
Well, Kelly talks about Sagan near the end of this piece, because and talking about, well, he's a lot like me. He recognises himself in Sagan's style, and he said, well, yeah, if I rode, like, in fact, he actually says, I had finished second an awful lot of times, but you know, nobody really remembers that. But you know, he said he finished first
an awful lot more.
But you know, Sagan's a little bit naive. You know, you just need a little bit more tactical nous, and he'll be there. But yeah, that was my take on Sagan.
Sagan immense on this year's Tour de France?
Yeah, awesome.
I mean, he just enlivened.
Apart from the podium celebration with the machine gun thing, you see that one?
Right. Yeah,
not,
I saw
not
that
one of his
right
better moments.
No.
on a day when police are firing machine guns on the Champs Elysees in the morning.
I thought it was all right. I mean, all that nonsense they're given on the podium anyway. You know, what are you supposed to do with it?
Yeah. Okay.
There are some great pictures in the Kelly article, and I nearly chose a couple of them actually as my sort of favourite pictures from this edition. There's a lovely picture of him and Robert Miller, both looking absolutely classic, you know, absolutely in their prime. Miller, I think, riding an MBK, which he used to say was amongst the worst bikes ever made.
Kelly on his Vitus.
Well, yeah, there's loads of lovely pictures of Kelly on that sort of classic old Vitus 979, the old alloy frames, which were floppy as anything, but they did look brilliant and didn't seem to do Kelly any harm. But
because he got a new one for every race, I think.
The pictures in that are great, but I guess if we're talking about our favourite photos from the issue, which we should move on to, for me, because I'm such a technical obsessive and mechanical obsessive, the photographs in the article about Specialized are brilliant for me. I am one of those people who, if I'm on following a race, will go and stand in the hotel car park and watch the mechanics fiddling with bikes, and I love to see which tools, which sort of Allen key they're using, and some of the photographs in the Specialized article.
You're getting us worried here. Yeah, you do that.
I should be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I'm going for one of Marshall Capel's on page 100, and it's of a bunch of riders coming through the feed zone, with Musettes flying left, right, and centre. I just love the way they're sort of launched in the air, and that he's managed to catch them in midair, and it sort of makes you realise how swift the whole operation is. You know, I think they've probably just collected them about 30 seconds earlier, around the neck, take out what they want, bosh, into the kerb, and then on you go.
I think someone says in the article that is another thing you never see on TV, the feed zones,
yeah,
which normally come during a boring bit of the yeah. stage. And a couple of times I've actually sort of parked up in a feed zone and just stood there and watched. It's amazing, absolutely terrifying. Mm. It's amazing spectator sport watching them go through and pick up those mizettes.
It's most terrifying for the soigneurs. I mean, I've done it as a soigneur, and it's petrifying. It's absolutely petrifying.
Because the opportunity to cause absolute carnage is
and
huge.
I would imagine that you are never in the right and the rider is never wrong, right? So
pretty
if they
much.
Miss their feed, that's a one-way street, isn't it? Yeah.
And I was doing it in a women's race in the Czech Republic, which was absolutely phenomenally hot. And they were all gasping. And so I'm standing there, I'm holding up my bottle for my rider. Another team's rider cut right across in front of her and knocked it out of my hand.
What do you do then?
She was that. Well, that was it. You know, I mean, my rider's gone without a bottle. I've got
A good. I remember when one of the early editions of the reincarnation of the Tour of Britain that I was covering. I think it was the first time Europe Car came across, plus Tommy Voerkler and the rest of them to ride, and on stage one, they completely missed their first feed because they'd never ridden in the UK before, and of course on the feed zones, they all stand on the left hand side of the road, so they all moved over to the right in the feed zone, and everyone else got them. They missed out completely.
Just standing in a nonchalant kind of way.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I like it.
I like that. It's a very good piece about musettes because they are such an anachronism, aren't they? That you just think, is there really no better idea than this kind of, you know, little stringy fabric thing with and bicycle wheels and long stringy, what do you call them, kind of strappy things that they just seem such a marriage made in hell. And you wonder why riders don't come down more often.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. First of all, though, have you, Ned, have you got
I'm jumping the gun, aren't I? pictures.
Yeah.
Oscar Freire in the Volkswagen Beetle. I'll leave it at that, and I'm sure Ian can explain why Oscar Freire is in a Volkswagen Beetle. But Tim Kern of the, what's his big book of portraits called?
The Peloton.
The Peloton fame, all those fantastic portraits of riders having just finished a race. Famous one of Cancellara, of course, including a famous portrait of Oscar Freire that sets this whole piece up. But he's got some lovely, very Tim Kern, black and white photographs, and there's a particular one of Freire's eyes reflected in the mirror of this Volkswagen Beetle, and a hand just shading the sunlight that's coming through the windscreen, and it's beautiful. And it's, I mean, great article that goes with it as well, because Freire is a fascinating guy, and one of those, every time you watched him race, it was a pleasure, wasn't it? Because unlike Peter Sagan, where it just explodes with naivety and exuberance, Freire was just one of those intuitively brilliant riders who, you know, got everything out of his physical capabilities he possibly could have done over the years.
If someone hasn't read the article yet, why is Oscar Freire in a Beetle?
He's in a Beetle that actually belongs to the writer of the piece, Pedro Orillo, a former teammate of Freire's, who actually retired following an horrendous crash going off the side of a mountain. A terrific writer and a good friend of Freire's, and they have this old Beetle. And when I say a rally, they don't hammer the thing, you know, for hundreds of miles. It's a regularity rally, so it's about getting there in a set time, you know, on a set route. But I love the way Pedro ties in little anecdotes from, you know, he'll talk about them getting lost and going round a roundabout twice, and he'll say, oh, that's the thing with Oscar, is he, you know, and he cites two of his wins where by going around a roundabout a different way to everyone else, he managed to win the race. You know, he's a smart rider, Mr. Freire. And yeah, one of the greats, I think. So it's a very different angle, and nicely done, I thought.
Yeah.
And he talks about him kind of drifting, zoning out during races, and drifting through races at certain points, and then being super concentrated at other points. And,
yeah.
And he's a player. I remember when I first started commentating, and the first race I did with David Miller, featured a Thomas Voerkler contested stage win on the Tour de Yorkshire, who's away with a group of three or four others. And, you know, you and I and the rest of us who kind of watch Voerkler know that he's a smart rider. But to hear Miller elucidate quite how smart and in infinite detail, step by step, pedal turn by pedal turn, what he was doing that was so clever, I was thinking of that when I was reading about Freire there, because I think they weren't dissimilar in that respect. You know?
Yeah.
Because what is he? What is Wöckler really, apart from a super talent, but not one of the greats? But he's just squeezed everything out of, you know, his career that he possibly could have done. And the same's true of Freire, I think.
Were there any other articles as you were reading through, Ned, that really stood out for you?
Mm. I've really mentioned it. I've got a soft spot for the Tour of Britain, always have done. And Ian, you spent a lot of time with anyone who's been on any domestic race will know the bald-headed dome of Mr. Andy Hawes, who's the race master.
Let's call him Route Master, because that's what I call the feature. Yeah,
Mick Bennett is the race director, his gig, but Andy Hawes actually, you know, works out that it's going to start at A, go to B, and go over that road and down that road. And so he actually works out what the race is.
A region will have paid to host the race. They're going to want to show off their best bits.
Yeah.
So the stage that I went on with Andy was between Stoke and Nottingham. You know, not two terribly attractive towns, it must be said. But, you know, every single town you went through throughout the whole route was just glorious. I mean, it is a tour of the Peak District, and it's quite intentionally so.
But you've also got to make it a good race as well.
Of course. Yeah.
It's actually such a difficult job. I every time I see a bike race, and you've got to make sure that the police forces are all engaged. Every single county has a different attitude, and some are really restrictive and really difficult. I've been, if I can be allowed, I've been lobbying Mick Bennett, who I know quite well, having worked with him down the years, for the last couple of years, to bring the penultimate stage of the Tour of Britain to finish here at Herne Hill Velodrome, a la Paris-Roubaix. Mm. The primary reason why they're kind of shying away from this at the moment is that Burbage Road has speed bumps on it, which would be a problem. They're quite shallow speed bumps, actually, but there is a way around that. You can remove them. I mean, you can dig them out and reinstate them. And it does get done on races, but expensive, obviously, so the council would have to fork up for that. And equally, you'd have to make sure, just because of the turning into the velodrome and the race is thinned out to the point of, you'd have to get a group of three or four max coming in there. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So you'd have to make the race sufficiently hard, and you'd have to bring it over, you know, several climbs through Crystal Palace, I would imagine, just to thin it out and make sure that's raced hard.
It would be brilliant, but it does sound horrendously complex.
They haven't ruled it out. I think they really like the idea, because Mick Bennett, obviously, having been a track, you know, bronze medalist in the Olympic Games in Munich in his own right, he spent a lot of his racing career down here and winning. So I think for nostalgic purposes, and absolutely, can you imagine, we're just sitting here, and what it would look like on the day to bring a race of the statue.
So many races used to finish on velodromes, didn't they, back in the day?
I think every race should finish in a velodrome. I just think, if anyone...
It should be the law.
You know, should be the law. I mean, it's a wonderful way to have a lap, you know, around it. It'd just be great. But Twitter hashtag. Let's put a bit of pressure on this.
If anyone's wondering what the whistling is in the background, it seems to stop now, there is a group of young riders, sort of in their early teens, going around and being taught how to change off the front at speed.
Some of them look terrifyingly good as well, don't
they? Yeah, some of them do look well. You know, Bradley Wiggins started down here. We've got a couple of members of the current British development squad who started down here. It's a place that does breed champions, and there may be one out there at the moment just learning how you get to the front of a group and pulling off. Should we do the competition now before we talk about
Musettes? Oh, yes, indeed.
Last time, the competition was to predict who would win on the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe how many people went for Mark Cavendish. Yeah.
None? Some? Lots?
Nearly all.
Were they watching the Tour de France?
I think they're British. Just like, you know, right. People like that should not bet. That's all I can say. Andre Greipel. Mr. Matthew Marquez in Australia.
Wow, and he gets one of Richard Mitchelson's Zed prints
from the issue 16 cover, which is a lovely prize. Now, for this issue, we have a Campagnolo C Record T-shirt. You'd like that, wouldn't
I'd
you?
Love
yeah,
that. Can I enter?
No. Which shows the, you know, the iconic. Yeah. Campag.
I do have one of those Campagnolo Spoken Here T-shirts, you know, the old shops.
Sorry, can I just say, I've no idea what you're talking about.
What?
What's the prize?
It's a T-shirt with a Campag C record on it.
I didn't say T-shirt.
I did?
Okay, all right. All right. It's got a picture
of... Rear mech.
A Campagnolo C record, a classic of its kind.
Rear mech.
Yeah.
You're showing yourself up here.
Well, who's showing who up? Go on. So it's a T-shirt with a bit of a bike component on it.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Do you want to know what the question is?
Yes, Ian? I'd love to. Yeah, I would, because I'm going to enter under an assumed name.
Sean Kelly won the last of his green jerseys in 1989. What colour was the other jersey he won that year? He won more than one classification.
Good question.
Very good question.
And bonification.
Of course, Kelly won the Vuelta, and that's where you're off to next, or at least that's where you're covering next.
Yeah. If I'm perfectly honest, I'm not off there. It's going to be very much by remote control from London. But David Miller and I are commentating on the race, so at the moment I'm immersed in trying to figure out 198 rider biographies without actually knowing who's going to ride, which is tricky.
Any early sort of predictions or any thoughts of...
No, I mean, there is a team time trial. There is an individual time trial. And there are, I think, five mountain... I haven't actually looked at the course in great detail yet, but I think it's five summit finishes at least, and then lots of punchy little ones. So, you know, as per normal with the Vuelta, the mountains come pretty early on as well. There's an extraordinary offering from both Movistar and Astana in the pipeline. So Astana in particular come to the party with Fabio Aru and Mikel Landa, second and third in the Giro, and one Vincenzo Nibali, fourth in the Tour de France. So that's their team.
Wow.
Movistar are turning up with Valverde and Quintana. And Tinkoff Saxo don't have, what's his name? Contador, but they do have Rafa Maika, who will notionally, at least this far out, lead the team. Then, that's before we've even got to Chris Froome, who said he's going to ride and he's only going to be interested in trying to win it.
Looking forward to it. So let's talk about Musette then. Now, of all the things in professional cycling that probably needed a rethink or a redesign, you might think, I'm not sure the Musette was top of the list. It's they're simple cotton bags that have been used for generations. What's wrong with them? Why have you redesigned them for
they're
the
rubbish,
21st century?
Aren't they? Well, come on,
they seem to do
their
job.
That was the whole reason I wanted to do this is because everything in cycling has changed immeasurably, especially in the last 30 years. Nothing has not been sort of radically rethought and, you know, from the ground up. And yet, there's this little cotton bag that causes no end of accidents and is utter mayhem. Nobody's even attempted to have a go at it, so I thought, why not?
So what did you do? You didn't have a go at designing it yourself?
No, I can't even draw.
Can I just ask a question about the traditional Musette?
Yes.
Why is the strappy bit so long? Because, I mean, I'm sure we've all picked up or nicked or been given Musettes at one point in our life and thought, it'd be quite handy to take that down the shops on my bike. And actually, it just sort of bangs around your arse or flops down the front and gets caught and caught on, bangs against the frame. Why do they hang so far down? Why?
Well, what's
the thinking there?
If you see the photos of the MTN Quebec of Swanee in there, it's like they put a knot in each one to make the strap short enough. So I don't know why they don't just make them that short in the first place. But it seems like that's been decided. This is the length.
I've always assumed that it's because if it's that length, it sort of rests against your back pockets and doesn't swing about too much. But maybe I'm wrong.
Well, bear in mind, you know,
it just seems a lot more swingy. So that, I don't know.
But the pro riders are literally, it's over the head, swing it round.
Get your stuff out.
You don't want it. You don't want it up around your neck. Imagine like level 42's Mark King playing a bass, yeah?
Good analogy.
You do not want it up there.
No.
Okay? You want it slung low, like Jean-Jacques Burnell. Or I can't think of another low-slung bassist at the moment.
Ask your parents, younger listeners.
Paul Simonon. That's where you want it.
Clash, not level 42.
No. Okay. No, every time.
Yeah.
Quick unload, bosh, throw it away.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But, you know, there's apart from the swinging Musette thing, which happens in an inordinate amount of times. So the moment they make contact with it, the bag just goes into a terminal spin, and then they have to unspin it before they can get it over their shoulder.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's the fact that they throw them away, they don't even get to the side of the road. So I've thrown basically this idea, you know, all the problems are with a Musette, over to a couple of designers, and they come up with an absolutely radical reworking of it.
And you've got one here.
Indeed. It's circular. There's a start. It's got an arobi. And for those of you who don't know what an arobi is, because I confess I didn't, it's kind of your modern frisbee.
It's a frisbee without a middle.
Exactly.
It's just not a big ring.
Not your old frisbee, not a great big border
when
plastic.
When you say modern, they've been around since the early 80s.
The 80s, yeah, I know, but that's modern for me. Yeah. Modern for, you know.
It's
I just
the
made
sort
a re-
of thing you throw on the beach, isn't
I
it?
I just made a reference to Jean-Jacques Bernin and Paul Simonon, for Pete's sake. You know, that's where I'm coming from.
The modern frisbee is known as the aerobic.
We're going to try it now. Ooh. So that actually kind of... You're struggling with this, aren't you?
It looks like you've designed a bag for an aerobie.
Yeah.
That's the best way of describing it. You've got an aerobie, and they've got a bespoke, semicircular little pouchette for your aerobie to take it down to the aerobie park to play a great fun game for all the family in your local park.
No, you're not taking this altogether seriously.
Well, no, but it only covers about three quarters of it, doesn't it? You see, anyone listening to your excellent description will have no idea what it looks like.
No, I don't. I might put a picture up on the website.
It's a ring with about a sort of three-quarter cover. If you imagine, it looks a bit like one of those covers you get for racing wheels, doesn't it?
Covers, yeah.
It doesn't go all the way around.
There is definitely a handmake.
What's the point in the aerobie again? That's a throwy thing then, is it? That's to make it throwable.
That was just a bonus, really. But the idea was to have a handle. So non-rigid handle, your normal sort of
strappy
handle, would be tucked inside.
Yeah.
And as the rider comes past, they grab the top of the aerobie, like that.
Yeah. Nice and then solid, it's dangling on their hand while they're riding along at speed.
One-handed.
They've got it.
Pull out the strappy bit.
So round the front.
So basically, you've created
unload
two
your
movements
stuff.
As opposed to one. So they've got to grab. They've got to grab it in their hand and then transfer it onto their shoulder.
Look, nobody said it's perfect, which is a work.
Did anyone
in
say it was any good?
You've actually tried this out for real, haven't you?
Yeah, with the Cannondale Garmin team.
Yeah.
No, they didn't totally dismiss it.
Did they mostly dismiss it? So do you stuff your food in there, as per normal?
It goes in there,
Is there room? There's not a huge amount of room in there.
That's another thing that needs...
There's no room for any food. It's full of aerobies.
it's a tight squeeze. It needs working on. Somebody's had a go at it.
And when they've got their food out of it, they take the strap off and they literally...
And you throw it and it's going to go...
out of the
belt. Decapitating.
Who was the sky rider who did that thing where he chucked his wheel in the air in frustration? It went off about 50 yards across the field. You must have seen that.
It'd
be a similar thing to that. It's going to catch on the wind and it's going to shoot off across the fields. And then
probably come back. It's not like a boomerang.
Yes. But that's the thing. If the wind is coming from that side of the road...
It will come back and take the...
There is the danger it will come back and decapitate somebody. It's a work in progress.
Yeah. I think generally... You're right, though. Someone's got to come up. Someone's got to nail this because it's time to move on.
There's got to be a better way. Or reorganise the whole feed zone in some way.
It'd be much less fun, wouldn't it? A lot of the riders do say, actually, they don't bother with the feed zone because all they do is wait another couple of miles, then drop back to the car.
And get their
food and drink from the team car. Yeah.
Well, that's what Joe Dombrowski. We've decided was pronounced.
Yeah, Joe.
that's what he does. He says, you know what, I don't bother. I can't be done with the hassle, and I'd rather go back to the car.
I remember Rob Hales telling me when he was working on the Secret Squirrel Aerodynamic Wind Tunnel Club at British Cycling that they figured out that if you attach to the front of a helmet on a kind of dangly pole thing, something like a tennis ball, ping pong ball, like
carrot.
That, yeah, at about sort of 2 foot in front of the helmet, that would break the airflow and give you an aerodynamic advantage, like a dangler, like one of those angler fishes, like that. But again, you know, what price do you want to pay for a little bit of aerodynamic advantage when everyone's going to laugh at you? And it just kind of, it went away.
So maybe back to the drawing board with the aerodynamic tennis ball
dangler. I'm going to use one next week here.
And good luck with that.
Excellent. I know where it's going to get you.
And good luck with the redesign of the Musette. We look forward to some more innovative ideas. Perhaps, is there another 80s beach toy that you haven't exploited?
Space hopper.
I shouldn't have said that, should I? Okay, that is it from this podcast for issue 57. I'm Ian Parkinson. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Ian Cleverly. Thanks to Ned Bolting.
Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.